to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. I hope you've all had a wonderful week. My name is Greg Sandin. I am this morning's representative from the church board. We have a variety of announcements about church life and activities. Please read your orders of service. We be sure and take these home as well to finish reading all the different announcements. The additional ones I have in front of me are the menu for the future discussion group will meet today at 11:45 in classroom number one. And on the monthly food pantry, that collection is today. It is this time sponsored by the Social Action Committee and is for our food pantry of Waukesha County. Monetary donations will be collected during the offertory. Loose cash donations will go to the food pantry. Checks can be made out to LCUUC with the amounts of the food pantry, for the food pantry and LCUUC noted in the memo line or check envelope. Food contributions can be placed in the bin in the foyer labeled food pantry. I invite you to greet those around you. If you are visiting us today, we particularly welcome you. Please sign the guest ledger on the visitor's table in the foyer. There's a variety of information available on that table in the foyer about church and Unitarian Universalism. Please help yourself to any of these items that interest you. I'll be in the social hall after the service if you have any questions about our church or if you have been visiting for a while and would like information about becoming a member. I'd be happy to speak with you about that. If you are visiting us with your children, it is our custom for the children to remain with us until after the offertory, at which time they go to their religious education classes. Your child is welcome to join them or remain in the service. The exception today, however, will be that, contrary to what the order of service says, the high schoolers will remain in the service. They are asked, however, to meet briefly in the regular classroom right after the service. If you'd like to go along to observe your child's class, please do so. The nursery is just out the doors to my right and across the entryway, if there is a need for child care during the service. Classes will end at 11:15, at which time you can pick up your children from the class. We always enjoy getting to know our guests. If any members have brought guests today, we would be pleased if you would introduce them. And if any guests have brought themselves and feel comfortable introducing themselves, this would be a great time to do so. We would really enjoy getting to know you. Everyone is invited to gather in the social hall after the service for refreshments and conversation. The conversation corner is a good place to gather for further discussion about the service. Please put your cell phones on silence mode during the service. I hope you find this morning's service inspiring and psychedelic. Our speaker today is our own Reverend Jane Espenson. Peace, man.
The glories of peace. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning forks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation. Neither shall they learn war anymore, but they shall all sit under their own vines and fig trees, and no one shall make them afraid.
I will now read the chalice lady. At times, our own light goes out and is rekindled by a spark from another person. Each of us has cause to think with deep gratitude of those who have lighted the flame within us. today's service, there are no songs that will be sung out of the gray hymnal or out of the blue song journey book. All of the words for the songs that we'll be singing today are in your order of service. And since, hey man, this is the 60s, you can either stand or sit to sing, whatever you feel. So our first song of the morning is If I Had a Hammer. Join in the sit-in are most welcome. I used to have to wear glasses in the 60s, so I'm not having to grab the program today that I'm going to be talking to the adults about has to do with standing by your own convictions. Do you know what convictions means? What does that mean? To stand by your convictions. It means to do what you believe in and to not give up in what you know is true and right, even if there are people who say something against you. And it's about perseverance. Do you know what perseverance means? Anybody? Mikey, do you know what perseverance means?
It means to stick to something, stick-to-itiveness.
It's stick-to-itiveness. It's not to give up. So this is a story that was written in the 1960s. It's a story by Dr. Seuss, and it's called Horton Hatches the Egg. I'm going to read, and Barb is going to show you all the pictures, because the pictures are very important here. Sighed Maisie, a ladybird hatching an egg. I'm tired, and I'm bored, and I've kinks in my leg from sitting, just sitting here day after day. It's work. How I hate it. I'd much rather play. I'd take a vacation, fly off for a rest, if I could find someone to stay on my nest. If I could find someone, I'd fly away free. Then Horton the elephant passed by her tree. Hello, called the lazy bird, smiling her best. You've nothing to do, and I do need a rest. Would you like to sit on the egg in my nest? The elephant laughed. What of all silly things? I haven't feathers, and I haven't wings. Me on your egg? Why, that doesn't make sense. Your egg is so small, ma'am, and I'm so immense. Tut, tut, answered Maisie. I know you're not small, but I'm sure you can do it. No trouble at all. Just sit on it softly. You're gentle and kind. Come, be a good fellow. I know you won't mind. I can't, said the elephant. Please, begged the bird. I won't be gone long, sir. I give you my word. I'll hurry right back. Well, I'll never be missed. Very well, said the elephant, since you insist. You want a vacation? Go fly off and take it. I'll sit on your egg and I'll try not to break it. I'll stay and be faithful. I mean what I say. Toodaloo, sang out Maisie and fluttered away. The first thing to do, murmured Horton. Let's see. The first thing to do is to prop up this tree and make it much stronger. That has to be done before I get on it. I must weigh a ton. Then carefully, tenderly, gently he crept up the trunk to the nest where the little egg slept. Then Horton the elephant smiled. Now that's that. And he sat, and he sat, and he sat, and he sat. And he sat all that day, and he kept the egg warm. And he sat all that night through a terrible storm. It poured, and it lightened, it thundered, it rumbled. This isn't much fun, the poor elephant grumbled. I wish he'd come back, because I'm cold and I'm wet. I hope that Maisie bird doesn't forget. But Maisie, by this time, was far beyond reach, enjoying the sunshine way off in Palm Beach. And having such fun, such a wonderful rest, decided she'd never go back to that nest. So Horton kept sitting there day after day, and soon it was autumn. The leaves blew away, and then came the winter, the snow and the sleet, and icicles hung from his trunk and his feet. But Horton kept sitting and said with a sneeze, I'll stay on this egg and I won't let it freeze. I meant what I said and I said what I meant. An elephant's faithful, 100%. So poor Horton sat there the whole winter through, and then came the springtime with troubles anew. His friends gathered round and they shouted with glee. Oh, look, Horton, the elephant's up in a tree. They taunted, they teased, and they yelled. How absurd. Old Horton, the elephant, thinks he's a bird. They laughed and they laughed. Are you lost, oh, my dear? They laughed and they laughed, and they all ran away, and Horton was lonely. He wanted to play. But he sat on the egg and continued to say, I meant what I said, and I said what I meant, an elephant's faithful 100%. No matter what happens, this egg must be tended. But poor Horton's troubles were far, far from ended. For while Horton sat there so faithful, so kind, three hunters came sneaking up softly behind. He heard the man's footsteps. He turned with a start. Three rifles were aiming right straight at his heart. Did he run? He did not. Horton stayed on that nest. He held his head high and he threw out his chest and he looked at the hunters as much as to say, shoot if you must, but I won't run away. I meant what I said and I said what I meant, an elephant's faithful 100%. But the men didn't shoot. Much to Horton's surprise, they dropped their three guns and they stared with wide eyes. Look, they all shouted, can such a thing be? An elephant sitting on top of a tree? It's strange, it's amazing, it's wonderful, new. Don't shoot him, we'll catch him. That's just what we'll do. We'll take him alive. Why, he's terribly funny. We'll sell him back home for a circus for money. And the first thing he knew, they had built a big wagon with ropes on the front for the pullers to drag on. They dug up his tree and they put it inside with Horton, so sad that he practically cried. "We're off," the men shouted, and off they all went, with Horton unhappy 100%. Up out of the jungle, up into the sky, up over the mountains 10,000 feet high, then down, down the mountains and down to the sea went the cart with the elephant, egg, nest, and tree. Then out of the wagon and onto a ship and out over the ocean, and oh, what a trip. Rolling and tossing and splashed with the spray, and Horton said day after day after day, "I meant what I said, and I said what I meant, but oh, am I seasick 100%. After bobbing around for 2 weeks like a cork, they landed at last in the town of New York. "All ashore," the men shouted, and down with a lurch went Horton the elephant, still on his perch, tied onto a board. They could just scarcely hold him. Bump! Horton landed, and then the men sold him. Sold to a circus. Then week after week they showed him to people at 10 cents a peek. They took him to Boston, to Kalamazoo, Chicago, Weehawken, and Washington, too, to Dayton, Ohio, St. Paul, Minnesota, to Wichita, Kansas, to Drake, North Dakota. And everywhere thousands of folks flocked to see and laugh at the elephant up in a tree. Poor Horton grew sadder the farther he went, but he said as he sat in the hot, noisy tent, "I meant what I said, and I said what I meant, an elephant's faithful 100%. Then one day, the circus show happened to reach a town way down south, not so far from Palm Beach. And dawdling along way up high in the sky, who, of all people, should chance to fly by but that good-for-nothing bird, Runaway Maisie, still on vacation and still just as lazy. And spying the flags in the tents just below, she sang out, "What fun! Why, I think I'll go to the show." And she swooped from the clouds through an open tent door. "Good gracious," gasped Maisie, "I've seen you before." Poor Horton looked up with a face white as chalk. He started to speak, but before he could talk, there rang out the noisiest ear-splitting squeaks from the eggs that he'd sat on for 51 weeks. A thumping, a bumping, a wild, alive scratching. "My egg," shouted Horton, "my egg, why, it's hatching." "But it's mine," screamed the bird when she heard the egg crack. The work was all done, now she wanted it back. "It's my egg," she sputtered. "You stole it from me. You took it off my nest. Now get off of my tree." Poor Horton backed down with a sad, heavy heart. But at that very instant, the egg burst apart, and out of the pieces of red and white shell from the egg that he'd sat on so long and so well, Horton the elephant saw something whiz. It had ears and a tail and a trunk, just like his. And the people came shouting, "What's this all about?" And they looked and they stared with their eyes popping out. Then they cheered and they cheered and they cheered more and more. They'd never seen anything like it before. "My goodness, my gracious," they shouted. "My word, it's something brand new. It's an elephant bird." And it should be, it should be, it should be like that, because Horton was faithful. He'd sat and he'd sat. He meant what he said and he said what he meant, and they sent him home happy 100%. Thank you. This is the time in our service for our offertory, and I will read some words by Brandock Lovely. "Let there be an offering to sustain and strengthen this place, which is sacred to so many of us, a community of memory and of hope, for we are now the keepers of the dream."
human kindness overflowing, and I think it's going to rain today. Scarecrows dressed in the latest stars, with frozen smiles to keep love away. Human kindness, it's overflowing, and I think it's going to rain. Lonely, lonely. I'll kick it down the street. That's the way to treat a friend. Right before me, the signs implore me, help the needy and show them the way. Human kindness overflowing, and I think it's going to rain today.
Good morning. I'm Rob Soar, and I was at the front of the program, but I'm going to be in the middle. The top 10 reasons why I value LCUUC. Number 10. It welcomes, supports, and befriends me. The friendships I have made take me beyond church life. Our community reaches out to each other with true kindness and care. Number 9. It provides a place for me to express myself musically. I never was in a formal choir until I came to LCUUC. The blending of harmonies and the variety of songs is a fun, challenging, and inspiring adventure for me. Number 8. It taps the musical talent of our membership. LCUUC is gifted with many talented musicians and speakers. This infusion of talent inspires me to pursue my passions. Number 7. It provides religious education for my kids. My kids can discuss issues related to a variety of philosophies. They can interact with kids with new insights on the world and know their views will be respected. Number 6. It highlights the strength and character of our youth. The fifth grade and high school transition programs leave me in awe at our kids' confidence and ability to articulate their values and future aspirations. Number 5, it helps me think in new ways. Services and guest speakers provide supportive and differing perspectives that influence my spiritual journey. Number 4, it rises to the challenge to create and maintain a home for UUs and other spiritual seekers. Members step into roles to make LCUUC the best place for all. We are fortunate to have leaders who have a vision for our church community and the wider community, now and into the future. Number 3, it respects the interdependent web of life. I am proud that our church is going solar and will be a role model for renewable energy in the community. Number 2, it celebrates our community through social events and church gatherings. My connection to others grows stronger when our community comes together at retreats, auction social gatherings, brew fest, Thanksgiving, and other church offerings. And the number one reason why I value LCUC is it accepts me for who I am, values my opinion, and laughs at my jokes, most of the time.
And now is the time in this service that we offer up our joys and concerns. Please wait for an usher to bring you a microphone and tell us your name and your joy or concern. I will light a first candle for all those caught up in the convulsion of politics and political change around the world. Hello, my name is Michelle, and we are returning members after a long hiatus. I wanted to have a candle of joy lit for my mother, Bonnie, who is going on a year and 7 months after being diagnosed with terminal cancer when they did give her 6 months after chemo, even with chemo. So she's definitely beat the odds, even though the chemo is still starting to affect her more than the cancer at this time. And it's wonderful to see Peace Day on a day that we finally return after a year when I myself am a misplaced hippie from the wrong era. So it was very nice to be welcomed back in such a peace-loving way. Thank you. I invite you now to take a moment of silent meditation, reflection, and prayer. And I will lead us into that by reading these words by Archibald MacLeish. And it is entitled, The Young Dead Soldier. The young dead soldiers do not speak. Nevertheless, they are heard in the still houses. Who has not heard them? They have a silence that speaks for them at night and when the clock counts. They say, we were young, we have died, remember us. They say, we have done what we could, but until it is finished, it is not done. They say, we have given our lives, but until it is finished, no one can know what our lives gave. They say, our deaths are not ours, they are yours. They will mean what you make them. They say, whether our lives and our deaths were for peace and a new hope or for nothing, we cannot say. It is you who must say this. They say, we leave you our deaths,
give them their meaning. We were young, they say. We have died. Remember us. Please join now in singing Blowin' in the Wind.
See the sky. How many Good morning. Here are words written by Bob Dylan's girlfriend from the 60s, Susie Rotolo, from her memoir, A Freewheelin' Time, kind of like me, a memoir of Greenwich Village in the 60s. There were so many talents in those days who hung their work on gallery walls, who got on stage to sing, to perform, or to deliver stand-up commentary that was part and way ahead of the times. We were full of truths and enthusiasms, resentments, and of course, poetry, prose, and song. The words of President Kennedy's inaugural speech were the words we took to heart. Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Today, what's in it for me is the question most often asked. The 60s were an era that spoke a language of inquiry and curiosity, and rebelliousness against the stifling and repressive political and social culture of the decade that preceded it. History is accumulated one day at a time, and there were many of us who moved it along. I'm proud to have been in the mix. I'm glad I took the subway and got off at the right stop. That's heavy.
And now Bob Dylan will join us in singing The Times They Are A-Changin'.
I'm gathering people wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changin'. I'm writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win, for the times they are a-changin'. Oh, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changin'. The mothers and fathers throughout the land, that don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your own road is rapidly aging. Please get out of a new one if you can't lend your hand. Oh, the times, they are a-changin'. The curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last. For the time they are a-changing.
When President Kennedy was shot, I sat on the floor of our living room and cried along with the rest of my family as we watched the repeated black and white scene of him waving and smiling in his limousine next to his pretty dark-haired wife and then suddenly falling into her lap. It was 1963, and I was 6 years old. It was my first brush with death. My second brush was a few days later, when again, right before my eyes, Lee Harvey Oswald was killed, and Jack Ruby was the name that was uttered. I grew up with killing, death, war, assassinations, Cuba and Khrushchev, fallout shelters and air raid drills, and words from the prior war still ringing in the air, chinks, wasps, Japs, Kikes and nigger. And Helen Keller and Anne Frank were also there, so courageous and bright, just children like me. Would I ever do anything meaningful in my life to be remembered? Walt Disney presents every Sunday night, with Tinkerbell so sweetly touching her wand to the sky above the castle turret, and Flubber, or Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, or Haley Mills, trapped in some cave while the sea waters crashed and rose to threaten certain death, while on the opposite channel, the Lawrence Welk show and his bubbles were an option we never chose. We played kick the can with all the neighbor kids at night while our parents sat on front porches and played cards, and we ducked under our desks at school during the day for cover from the Russian communists who were a part of the Cold War that was always looming at the edges of our world. Ragged and crying women and children walked along the long and sandy roads in Vietnam, while our tired and faded and dusty soldiers walked alongside them, helping them onto planes where they would be safe, or being carried themselves onto those planes by their comrades because they no longer had legs to walk with. We ate dinner and watched this plight every evening, and the Huntley-Brinkley Report with Chet and David told us about the world, and Walter Cronkite ended every newscast with, "And that's the way it is." And that's the way it was. I grew up in a world that was built like a kaleidoscope. You look through a small, clear lens at the simple, pure world that was around you like a protective coating, a world that encompassed baseball games and paper routes and apple pie, Donna Reed and Dennis the Menace, Father's Knows Best, and My Three Sons. And through the other side of the kaleidoscope, the world you were shown was broken up into shards and angles of color and shapes that were unrecognizable to your daily world. The civil rights movement and the death of Martin Luther King Jr., and so too of his dream. A few months later, the assassination of young Bobby Kennedy, who we loved because he was JFK's brother. And although my brothers and I played cops and robbers or cowboys and Indians with all of the guns and fake deaths those games required, real deaths were always around us. Not the least of which the Vietnam War with its body bags and flag-draped caskets and 21-gun salutes, the Pledge of Allegiance starting each day, often interrupted by the sound of sonic booms, and each day ending with Nancy Drew mysteries or Daniel Boone or Gulliver's Travels. A childhood built around fantasy and imagination mixed with real life and death and death and death. And then I turned 11, and we moved to Florida, where I had the opportunity to be one of a handful of white students in an all-black school. Having grown up with the civil rights movement, actually over by the time I was conscious of it, it was still a movement that I supported and was deeply affected by. My being Jewish in the small town of Duluth, I was acutely aware of prejudice and was committed to standing up for injustices and wrongs wherever they might occur. But that was being brave in the midst of relative safety. Now in Florida, I had the chance to not only support the rights of blacks, but to see what it was like to be a true minority. For if I was ever going to be a part of the cause, and causes were the backdrop of my existence, then I felt that I could only do that authentically by being right in the midst of truth. I read Cry the Beloved Country about the apartheid in South Africa. I read every book I could find about the Underground Railroad system during the Civil War, knowing full well that I would have been an abolitionist if I had lived during that time. And I read Black Like Me, a true story of a white journalist who stains his skin black in order to be able to pass as black while traveling through the Deep South and write about the difficulties blacks faced in at least those parts of the United States. I wanted to be a journalist and write about things that mattered. When I was 12, I followed the political life of a black woman named Shirley Chisholm, who later ran for president. I went to a rally for her once where we ate soul food, and I got to sit next to her and talk about the future, and she told me to become a politician, or at least an ambassador, or go into the Peace Corps and work with the needs of those who lived in the most troubled countries. And I vowed that I would do that. And still the Vietnam War raged on, and I turned 13. And my skirts got shorter, and my hair grew down my back, and the smell of pot and the sound of the sitar filled the air. The first step for mankind took place on the moon while we were watching Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, and the Smothers Brothers were acting goofy, and bell-bottoms and Nehru collars, long skirts and long hair, and peace signs and protests and sit-ins and Woodstock, and young people were everywhere. The men on the news were old. Our teachers were old. Our parents were old. Everyone was old but us. And I wasn't even really one of the us because I was still so young. But I was really influenced by the usness of those youth, by their anti-disestablishmentarianism, by the counterculture, by the Beatles' White Album and Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, which we all knew stood for LSD. And tripping and psychedelic music and just being free to be you and me. And still the war raged on. And the youth continued to be the voice of the nation, the power, the strength, the no-nonsense attitude of calling an end to the needless war and to call out the hypocrisy of the people, their parents' ages, who had said no more war after World War II, who had said never again. And then came Vietnam, and again was the name of the game for a war. No one knew why we were there, and our brothers and our cousins and our sons and our all-too-young boys in the neighborhood were being drafted and sent to die for a cause no one wanted to be a part of. And the nation didn't end the war, but turned its back on the soldiers that very war destroyed, and those young men came back to abuse and to shunning, and to a land that turned them out into the streets. When I was 14, I got a POW MIA bracelet with the name of First Lieutenant. First Lieutenant Eric J. Huerth, and the date of 5/13/70, engraved upon it. And I wore that bracelet until I was 48 years old, when one day
I did an internet search on Eric J. Huberth and found out that he'd been promoted to a captain while in the intervening years, but that he was still missing in action. And the day I found that news, the bracelet on my wrist split in two. I still have it in a drawer in my house. Make Love Not War was the slogan of the 60s. Peace signs and flower power signs and Women's Lib and Pete Seeger and Bob Dylan and Peter Paul and Mary and Joan Baez and the mamas and the papas and those young people around me, those university students who seemed very old to me, were solid and grounded and sure and feisty. They didn't just sing, they sang out. They didn't just complain, they demonstrated. They didn't just wring their hands and wonder what was happening to our country. They protested and they fought and they took to the streets and they took over Greenwich Village and they created a segment of the culture that wasn't just their own, it was ours. It wasn't a subculture, as they called it, but it was the real world that I grew up in and was influenced by. Those young people of that day, who were at least 10 years older than I was, were the movers and shakers of that era. They told me, they told us all, to how to think and how to behave and what to believe in and what to react against. They showed us a world where the women were strong and the men were good looking and the children were above average. And I was one of those children. And I would one day be one of those strong women. And those young people of the 60s led by example and left a huge footprint for me to try to fit myself into. And try I did, for I believed in everything the world those young people had to show me, what they had created for me. And so here we are today, a nation as rife with angst and betrayal as ever the days of the 60s were. That brave new world those young people fought for was the world I was sure I would inherit, and my children and my children's children for seven generations hence. For so surely were those seeds sown, and so surely were those crops tended and harvested. So what happened? How did we get here from there? Where did we take a wrong turn? Where did it all begin, this downward, slippery slope of cutting back and cutting off and cutting out the security nets for the people of this great nation? Why did we turn a blind eye or turn a deaf ear or stand mute and become muddled and befuddled and in the end become downtrodden and hopeless so that the way was paved clear for these atrocities to occur? Who are we to blame? Where can we turn for help? Only to ourselves. And that is a great place to start. As hopeless as these times seem, we have the past to draw from, coupled with the wisdom of the current youth. We have those young people of the 60s in our midst here today, gray-haired perhaps. But that is of no consequence. Their hearts are the same, their feistiness no less, their souls not weakened but wiser, their resolve renewed by their hope for the youth of today, for the life they wish for today and for all the days to come, for the times they are a-changing and it has begun once more. Thank you. We have time in this service now for a polylog, which is our chance in this congregation to discuss what has been presented for the day. And we can do that for, 10 minutes or so, whatever, however long you would like. So you may speak.
Hi, my name is Cheryl. I'm a guest here today, and I just wanted to pass on a book that I read years ago called Johnny Got His Gun. It, in my opinion, gives a voice to soldiers that have died. It's a tragic book, but I think it's a really important read to young people.
Thank you.
I don't remember the name of the author, if anyone else does.
Okay.
Oh, Dalton Trumbo is the author. And thank goodness for Google.
Hi, my name's Al, and I'm trying not to be disgusted and angry with our society, and I appreciate your message, and I too have great hope and trust in our youth, certainly the youth of this congregation, and moreover, many of the youth that I have met are thinking more for just themselves.
Yeah, it was very exciting to be. I live in Madison, and I live very close to the campus. And one day, a couple of weeks ago, I don't have a TV, and I only listen to the radio back and forth, actually, from here to Madison. It gives me a great amount of radio time, I want to tell you that. And so I wasn't really up to date on some things, and I was downtown, and there were these marches and protesters, and I was thrilled, but I didn't really understand what it was about. And then somebody told me, and I was so excited, and then I learned more and more and more and more and more about the thousands and thousands of people who have surrounded the Capitol and gone inside, and we can't give that up, and we can't have those doors closed, and it's a public building, and we have to have the right to go inside, and we have to protest, and we have to make our voices heard, and we can't roll over and die and become silent. Our voices must continue on and on and on, just like in the 60s. It was years and years and years of people never, ever, ever giving up, and we cannot give up now. The end result will be too horrific.
Jane, my name is Mike. I was somewhat conservative in high school from 1966 to 1970s when I graduated. And I think a lot of my supposed conservatism at the time, even though I was deep down inside, I found out later I was a screaming liberal. I was explaining to somebody here, I was reading William F. Buckley Jr. at the time. But I think a lot of that was out of fear and out of a sense of protection or defensiveness for myself, because I wanted to come across as Joe Straight, forgive the pun, and Mr. Wright and Mr. Calm and just a regular person that seemed to know what he was doing and seemed to know what he was talking about and did not get too worked up about the stuff that was going outside there, like in Vietnam and whatever, because it'll all take care of itself. And I see now, of course, that was pure defensiveness and denial. And I think one of the things that helped me start to be able to deal with that and open myself up to the possibility that there's something I can actually do about it is when I discovered the power to do something about myself. I thought I was going to be stuck for the rest of my life in trying to be something that I wasn't, and when I realized not only could I be myself, but that's where the power lay, I don't know which word to use, that I discovered I had this powerhouse inside of me, and suddenly I was able to do things with other people, slowly, albeit, and be able to change other people because I was able to change myself. And it was a simple matter of discovering that I had a goodness inside of me that was just absolutely overwhelming. It was oceanic in its size, and I had no idea it was there. And that was, to me, that was the beginning of my own personal revolution. That I have to, if there's going to be peace on earth, I have to let it begin with me. And that I find out that, in fact, I can do it. And not to give up. If there's going to be hope, it has to be hope in myself as well.
But and the important thing, too, is not to let it just stay with you, but to share that message and share that concern and be angry. It's okay. And to be resolved and to fight for what you believe in and to spread the word and to not be shy, not be hesitant. Unitarian Universalists are notoriously bad about speaking about what we believe in, because we think that speaking about what we believe in is the same as proselytizing, and it isn't. It's just speaking about what we believe in. I want you to know that in the 1960s, the Unitarian Universalist and Unitarian and Universalist churches, and then Unitarian Universalists when they joined, were actual sanctuaries in the United States. They were one of the few religious institutions in the United States that literally opened their doors and took in conscientious objectors.
I'm Sonia. I was born in 1970, so let me tell you, in the 80s and the 90s, standing up and standing out was not encouraged, and there's a restlessness that comes with that, so I hope the times are changing, because I'm ready.
Great. We're ready for you.
My name is Jerry, and from Bob Dylan's words, times indeed are changing. Right now they're changing, in my opinion, in the wrong way. I think what we're seeing right now is a bona fide counter-revolution, where those in power now are trying to take us back to the days of Herbert Hoover. I've seen on TV the demonstrations in Madison, people of all ages. I've seen on Channel 4 especially, they're touting the pro-Walker demonstration, showing the people. The people are all old or old in spirit. If you're concerned about what's going on, get involved.
Yes, get involved.
Hi, my name is Tom, and I'm essentially the same age you are. I was a child in the 60s, not a child of the 60s, right? Mm-hmm. And I have a sort of an ambiguity in my feelings about the 60s. It's like there were two different 1960s for me. You know, on the one hand, I was learning these songs we're singing today. I learned them in Boy Scout camp, of all places. And at the same time, I had cousins in Eastern European countries where the governments were laughing at us and expected to bury us. And so, I have two different 1960s, and I've never really totally reconciled that.
I'm Betsy, and if you're wondering what to do to get involved, especially, I mean, I know a lot of people are going to Madison, but something that you can do around here is on March 17th, Common Ground is having a meeting. I have to look where I can put it in the order of service next week, to try to brainstorm about what to do to try to protect the assault on education that's going on.
I'm Joan. My son Ian and I went to Madison yesterday and heard Michael Moore and Tammy Baldwin speak, and I just want to say it's very alive in Madison right now. It's just amazing. It was an experience. If you want to experience what's being spoken about here today, go to Madison.
Hi, my name is Erin. You mentioned hope, and I think that hope is an important thing to not lose, that no matter how bad it looks, no matter how desolate it looks, the thing that has kept people alive since the dawn of time is hope, and a belief and a will to live and a will to survive, and your attitude in how you approach the crashing world around you is what keeps you alive. And the mantra that helps me is not really a mantra, it's an anonymous something serenity prayer, so I don't know if you've read it somewhere. But it's taken me years to understand, to accept the things I cannot change, to have the courage to go out and change what I can, and then to seek the wisdom so that I actually know when I can be effective and when it's not helpful to myself, my tribe, my people, the surrounding world. And the thing that I see that frightens me is the anger and the lack of hope and the lack of a willingness to look for a way to work it out. And right now what I see in Madison is the hope that people are willing to stick their necks out and do something. So thank you. Thank them.
Well, when you think about the Vietnam era that went on for a really long time, from time before I was born, actually, until I graduated from high school in 1975. I grew up with the scenes of that war on TV every single solitary day of my growing up. Every single solitary day of my growing up, I saw scenes from the Vietnam War every single solitary day. And in 1975, when the war ended, one day there was nothing. It was very strange and disconcerting. And it was an emptiness, but during that whole long time, that whole long period, never did the youth give up. Never, ever did the youth give up. And they were, and there were people who were for that war, absolutely, in the government and everything, but never did the people give up. Well, here we go again, and we cannot give up. We have to keep fighting. We can't just say, this is horrible, where are we headed to? But by God, no, never again. I'm sorry,
thank you.
Continue.
I'm Angela, again, and I was born in 1981, and I just had a conversation the other day with a friend, and I asked him, is there anywhere in the world that's like the 1960s? Because I think I want to move there. Because I think about what my parents have done and the stories my grandpa told growing up in California in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and just his persona and how he lived his life, and I don't see that very much anymore, and I don't know where it stopped being taught or maybe ignored, but I often wonder what happened. How did we raise a nation of people so far from the ideals that everybody who had the power to change things ended up growing us up? And at, you know, now I'm grown up and I'm going to be 30, so I think I have enough wisdom now in my life to make an effort of change, and I have the tools given to me by my grandparents to do so. But I think a lot of people my age either lack that or weren't taught that. But really, what happened? I don't understand what was done to make all of this possible, because this is my generation now handed this world, and I don't know if all of us know what to do with it.
Yeah. Thus the title of my sermon, Whatever Happened to the 60s. Exactly. I wonder as well.
Hi, my name is Steve. I'm a visitor here for the first time, and I first have to say this is very, very refreshing. I really appreciate this kind of different perspective for a church. This is a great thing. Second thing is, I was born in 1964, so the whole thing with the 60s and everything brings a lot of back a lot of memories for me. I have an aunt and uncle that went to Madison in the 60s. They met, they got married. They were on the Daily Cardinal, which was a publication at the time, a newspaper. So they were heavily involved with the anti-war protests and things like that. So I remember as a kid talking about how the world can change and how it can be better and everything. And I came of age, you know, I was around 15 or 16 when John Lennon was shot. AIDS, a lot of those things, I think, was one of the reasons why the whole zeitgeist, if you want to say, or at least the progressive movement, kind of was stalled for a while. It is a time, I think, for things to begin to reemerge. So I hopefully it will. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. I'm Bob Evans. I was born in 1955 and was in college during Vietnam. And thankfully for some college deferments and other things, I didn't wind up going over. Also the lottery and all that was going on. I was very impressed by the service today. I was very impressed by the message. It hasn't gone away. You can see it today in Libya. You've seen it in Egypt. And you know what the people of the world can do when they decide to rise up against government and government oppression. In the 60s, it was a very difficult time because most of the kids that were protesting couldn't vote. So we had no control over the government of the United States, but we tried to make our message known. And that's where the protests came from. And who were we trying to convince? The silent generation. So that was a very difficult time in the United States. There were so many protests for so many different reasons. The Black Panthers, the Students' Democratic Society, all of these different organizations had different messages all at once in the 60s. Today we see what's going on in Madison. I would suggest that anyone in this room under the age of 45 go back to the history books, because Madison was a hotbed in 1965 and 1966. There were more protests in this state than there were in California. Now, I'm from New York, and in New York we had our protests as well. And colleges and universities were bringing up kids in the military because they were earning their college education by being in the ROTC programs. And a lot of those kids went over to Nam and didn't come back. I had friends that the way they paid for their education was to take that training. And one friend of mine, he was in the shore patrol of the military police, and he said all of his buddies went over on convoy duty, and they were the guys standing up in back of the jeeps with the machine guns. He said he got lucky. He was dating the girl that typed up the orders and wound over in Germany. But all of his buddies in the patrols, and all killed. So it's a different world. You don't know what luck you have today. And while we fight for education and we fight for what's right, we are the generation that started this. We are the generation that votes. And to a certain extent, we brought Obama in to try to change the world. And I thank you very much.
Thank you. I will end with these closing words, and then we have one final song. This is by Rabindranath Tagore, and it's called Fearful Joy. Is it beyond thee to be glad with the gladness of this rhythm, to be tossed and lost and broken in the whirl of this fearful joy? All things rush on, they stop not, they look not behind, no power can hold them back, they rush on. Keeping step with that restless, rapid music, seasons come dancing and pass away. Colors, tunes, and perfumes pour in endless cascades in the abounding joy that scatters and gives us and dies every moment. Hit it, Joe.